Peter Moore came to the University of Kent in 1971, and it's a real privilege to catch up with Peter for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. I knew Peter for many years when we were colleagues at the University of Kent, and Peter reflects on the time that he came to the University of Kent and how it has changed over the years. We talk about Ninian Smart, discovering religious studies through literature, how multidisciplinarity is important. We find out about his pedagogical approach of always engaging with students at the level where they are. Now, Peter talks about his passion when he was young for Latin, how he doesn't have especially vivid memories of the past, the co-relationship between the past and the future, whether it's possible to be nostalgic about the 4 decades that he spent at the University of Kent. We talk about the long, hot summer of 1976 and where Peter was when he learnt about the death of John Lennon. He discusses his musical influences. We learn whether any film can be nostalgia-provoking. We find out about why Peggy Sue Got Married is a moving film about coming to terms with one's past. We talk about whether it is possible to share one's nostalgia with another person. We discuss how grief is one of the most extreme contexts for nostalgia and why mindfulness and Buddhism might be thought of as being the antithesis of nostalgia. And then in the final part of the interview, we discover whether there are any what-ifs in Peter's life and why he doesn't consider himself to be an ambitious person, as well as why he feels that the past is sometimes best left alone. So join me for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy, and my guest this week is Dr. Peter Moore. Well, it's a real privilege this afternoon to be with Peter Moore, and because we've known each other about 15 years.
That's right.
And I think actually you came to Kent the year actually I was born. So you have a wonderful sense of perspective, I would imagine, on this institution. It'd be lovely to get a sense from you about your life and career here.
1971 I came.
Ah, that's before me then.
Yeah. Although I was only taken on as a part-timer then, or rather, a temporary lecturer. And then that was confirmed, I think, the following year as a full-time post.
Yeah. So the university was founded in 1965. That's so right. You were here within about 6-7 years
that's right,
of starting.
Yeah. Very little building up then.
Yeah. Has it changed?
I was one of three people.
What, in religious studies?
Yeah. There was Professor Whitehouse and John Court, and myself, who was the kind of religious studies component of what was a theology department, or theology and religious studies, as we then became. And then I worked many years to try and get it to a full religious studies status, as it were, which eventually we managed to do.
I always associate it with the Lancaster model, because I think you did your PhD at Lancaster before coming here.
Yes, I saw myself as a kind of bodhisattva coming to fulfil the bodhisattva vow of getting religious studies to, as it were, absorb and replace theology. So I was very much a kind of disciple of Ninian Smart, who was my supervisor for my thesis.
Mm. I met Ninian Smart, actually, at one of the Basra conferences. It would have been 1996. And he was so not what I was expecting, because I think he was probably late 60s at the time.
Right.
And he was somebody who was clearly at home in an after-dinner speaking environment. He was such a wonderful personality. And
yep.
And his talks were wonderful, because everybody sort of went there thinking, this is Ninian Smart, let's take notes. But he was enjoying the opportunity to reflect on his career while he was talking. And of course, he wasn't sticking to any sort of script. But I think he's allowed to do that because his reputation preceded him.
That's right. Some of his most informative lectures were like kind of glorified after-dinner speeches. Mm. Plenty of jokes, a light touch. Mm. And some people, I know some academics, as they tend to be, were rather snooty about this and regarded him as not academic enough in that sense.
But in his writings,
he was a great
course.
Inspiration to many people.
Mm. No, and absolutely, and even with my own PhD supervisor. And I know in later years he was doing some work or publishing some articles in Implicit Religion, and I've drawn in on him quite a lot, actually, the whole sort of taxonomy category of religion work.
Yeah.
But, he was a very flamboyant character, and it was wonderful when I was at Lampeter, actually, to have Ninian Smart and John Hick
together, and they had very different personalities as well, but they were doing a sort of question and answer session. But one was perhaps a little bit more scripted than the other, and I'll leave you to work out which one was which. But again, you know, two very pioneering figures.
Yes, well, I went to Lancaster, you see, when Ninian was just starting his religious studies there. I went straight from Sheffield, where I'd done a degree and then a social science diploma, and I went to Lancaster having kind of discovered religious studies through literature in a way. And there he was, sitting in a corridor without really a department. Again, seemed to be making a habit of this, but it was just him and one other person. And I was, of course, one of his early graduate students. I mean, there were two members of staff, I think, maybe three. Yes, three. It was Adrian Cunningham, Bob Morgan, New Testament, and Ninian. I think those were the only three at the time. And then I was one of about 10 graduate students, some of whom he had brought from Birmingham, I think, who'd mainly Buddhist monks, I think there were. They sort of brought them with him to Lancaster. And that was the core of religious studies. And then gradually it grew and grew and grew, till eventually, because it fell apart in a way, as you probably know more than I do.
Mm. Yeah, later years.
But it was a great, while it lasted, it was a very sort of powerhouse of all kinds of...
But that's interesting, because I always associated, well, both Lancaster and but also Ninian Smart as these great bastions, you know, figures who were pioneering in their ways in the field of study of religion.
Yes.
And it's interesting how maybe then at the beginning, it wasn't almost inevitable that that was the career that Ninian Smart was going to take. It sounds as though he was in a small department, that he built that up, yes, and he developed the name. And then retrospectively, certainly with, I think, Santa Barbara he was associated with, and certainly Lampeter, he had an honorary professorial status. But has that been your experience as well in your career, the sense that in the way that you built up religious studies here at Kent, you know, it was your initiative that guided that particular sort of route, and it wasn't, you know, it's easy to look back and think, well, of course, in the case of Lancaster, of course religious studies was going to come to Lancaster, it was going to be its reputation, because that was what was built up. But you were there in the earlier days and probably saw a very different picture.
Well, I think Ninian had responded to an advert for a professor of any faith or none. And although he was actually quite traditional in his Episcopalian commitment, he liked the idea of being religious studies rather than theology. I think he'd been a philosopher of religion, really, I think. And then he was inventing the field even as he was founding it, of course. Whereas when I came to Canterbury, I had very clear, perhaps too clear, ideas of what religious studies was, and I was jolly well going to try and get it established here, because I saw it had tremendous potential, particularly links with other subjects, you see, which has always been my thing, if you like. I've never wanted to be a specialist.
Mm. But whenever I'm teaching my students on a Death of God module, we look at Paul Tillich and that whole sense of being almost a philosopher, a sociologist, a theologian,
exactly,
lots
yes.
of different hats that you can wear,
yes.
perhaps simultaneously, not being pigeonholed.
Yes, that's become much more respectable, as it were, in more recent years, the idea of multidisciplinary approaches to things. But there have been times in the past when it's been much more narrowly compartmentalized, I think. So I always saw religious studies as a multiple discipline, you know, bringing in everything from languages to history and sociology.
Because when I started looking at religion and film, I was conscious that there was something by its very nature interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
But I also felt that if it hadn't been for my background, which was in theology, I wouldn't have been able to do that interdisciplinary work. And I sometimes find, even now when I'm teaching on a religious studies program, that there are some students who may have a great passion for film, and maybe taking my module as a wild module, but in some cases they will struggle with some of the core religious or theological ingredients of what we're looking at. And I think as long as you have the right scaffolding in place, then it's possible to do all sorts of interdisciplinary things. But the interdisciplinarity can't come about unless you've got, you know, both feet, or, you know, one foot in each of the disciplines that you're interrogating.
Yes.
Was that your sense with literature?
Yes, and of course one of the things I liked to do when I was here, and once I sort of got myself more established, was invent courses which very much brought in other disciplines. Like, I used to teach with Chris Cherry in philosophy, a course called The Self, which was partly philosophy, partly religion, partly parapsychology, and that was an ideal course for me. And then when I invented a course called Myths, Symbols and Mysteries for Part 1 students, I made a point of engaging with the students at the level where they were, so that if they'd come from an English lit background or a French studies background or whatever it happened to be, geography, I could actually get them to use their whatever skills they had in those subjects to build up a topic of their own choosing. And they were allowed to do anything they wanted, almost.
Well,
providing it had some connection with Miss Symbols and Mysteries, which isn't difficult.
Well, I remember anecdotally one student saying to me a few years ago that you, whether this is true, I don't know, but I'd like it to be true, that apparently you'd banned them from doing Harry Potter because everyone was doing Harry Potter and it was taking over the course.
I did declare it to be a Harry Potter-free zone because I got so fed up with that rather narrow view of what magic was or what fantasy literature was. Lord of the Rings was fine, of course, much more serious stuff.
Well, I used to find sometimes that I'd ask students to write a commentary on a film, and very often a student would just tell me about their favourite film and why it was their favourite film, and I felt sorry for the student in a way, because I'd be grading them, but I can't grade them for just telling me why they liked a particular film, but I could also see that where the passion came from. And at the same time, I was thinking, well, in a different context, if you follow a different sort of route, what you're doing here is really good. You're sort of asking yourself what it is that provokes you, stimulates you. What is it about a particular text or a film that you find maybe transformative? But I think that in that case, almost like the autobiography was coming before the methodology.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think it's wonderful when students can find a passion, which they often then do via dissertations, and they can say, right, I've done all these modules, but I'm really into witchcraft or really into looking at Satan or science and religion, all sort of elements that they haven't done.
But I think it's a very important educational principle that you start from where the student is. And that might not suit some teachers. They might think, well, I don't really think much of that subject or that approach. But if you actually begin with an enthusiasm, you can then educate that, nurture it into something more serious. So in a way, I didn't really mind what they wanted to write their big dissertation on for that course, as long as I could somehow engage the enthusiasm. And I had one or two students who really had trouble finding a topic, and then in the end, we found something that they were not expecting at all for me to be interested in. But there it was, you know. It might be an interesting graphic novels or, I don't know, boxing or something completely alien to me, as it were. But we actually built something up from those interests that they had, and they often produced a very interesting dissertation. Because I then fed in material that I thought might be useful.
And it reminds me of Dead Poets Society, when Robin Williams' school teacher is trying to say, carpe diem, seize the day, educate your minds,
yes,
think outside of the box, and suddenly these students find that they do have a passion, but it's latent, because for them it's all about learning, not so much learning the poetry, but how poetry is configured, almost like the mathematics of poetry. And if you can then say, but why are you inspired, rather than trying to break down or assimilate or deconstruct all that, the sources of that, then actually,
yeah.
I mean, my experience with learning the piano, I found that I love music, but having to sort of do things in 6/8 or 3/4 and demiquavers and semiquavers, it took away some of the magic.
Yes.
Like driving a car, I suppose. The car will take me to the cinema, but actually, in terms of looking at the engine, it's like, no, that's another job. So I'll pay good money to at Halfords so they can do that, and then I can enjoy the journey and not worry about the science behind the car. It's the myth of the journey, I think is what gave me the incentive to drive. Because I sort of identified what was missing in my life, the things I wanted to do, and what public transport couldn't take me to. But if you apply that in lots of other capacities, whether it's research or teaching, then you're going to really galvanise students, as by the sound of it, they certainly were.
Yeah.
Going back a little bit first, before we perhaps know to have more to say about Ken, a little bit about your background, where you were born, when you were born. I'd be interested to see how you ended up both Sheffield and Lancaster, and then at Kent, and what were some of the inspirations along the way?
Yeah, well, I was born in 1945. My birthday is very easy to remember. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 12th of March, 1945. Born outside London, the end of the war. Spent my early youth in North London, and then went to Sheffield University. Well, perhaps I should tell you, I went to Stationers' Company School, and during the sixth form, I suppose, I really developed a passion for learning. Things took off from there. I had a couple of inspiring teachers who got me interested in English and French. And my favourite subject was Latin, actually, in which I did quite well. I often fantasise that I might have taken a different course had I pursued classics rather than what I did do, which was to go to Sheffield University and take English, French and philosophy. And I refused at any point to give up any of these subjects. I took them right through to a final, you see. So I actually have a degree in all three, which was not particularly easy, but worthwhile, I thought.
Oh, so did it take you longer to get the degree?
No, it didn't. It was simply that you could take an honours degree in all three. And so that's what I did. And, of course, it's the interconnections between these things that, I suppose, gradually led me to religious studies and hence to Lancaster and eventually to Kent. Mm. So it's kind of fairly chartable trajectory.
Yeah, I remember the advice that my PhD supervisor gave, which was that some of the best research is at the cutting edge between disciplines.
Yes.
And it sounds like, and I mentioned Paul Tillich earlier, but it sounds as though that's very much a model whereby through literature, perhaps, you found a route into the study of religion.
Yes, and of course the price I paid for it, from one point of view, from a kind of career point of view, is that, of course, I never really became an expert or a specialist in one area, which obviously had implications or repercussions for how my career went. But, I mean, I enjoyed it, and I think I'm still sort of benefiting from this fairly broad, multidisciplinary relationship to knowledge, if I can pretentiously call it that.
Mm. Because I actually struggled a bit after I got my PhD, because I thought, well, I've now done this interdisciplinary work, and I thought, well, that's what I have to do forever. It's almost as though I thought I'd be a charlatan if I wanted to branch out into another area, because I was only qualified here. And then I was conscious that I was working on publications. I thought I found a niche area in religion and film, but then I was worried that I was kind of recycling a lot of the same sort of thing. It was almost like I'd established the methodology, and therefore I couldn't write another book without almost sort of saying this is in keeping with those previous publications. And I think it took me a while to get outside of that comfort zone and to say I can look at Christmas, or I can look at nostalgia, or, well, Life After Death was a bit easier because I did a master's on that many years ago. But that was interesting because in those days we weren't looking at film. You know, in my undergraduate degree, for example, it was all very, you know, wonderful theology, lots of historical theology and systematic theology, and we were looking at ethics and doctrine. But it was only after I did the MA in Death and Immortality that a few decades later I thought, well, I watch all these films about Satan or Jesus, Santa Claus, where, you know, there may be life after death elements. And I thought, well, is there a way of going back to some of that research from the 1990s and then apply it to what's going on in film? And so that was an interesting way in, but it took me a few decades to be able to join those dots.
Yeah.
In terms of earliest memories, how far do you think you can go back?
Ooh. I'm actually not... I don't have a very strong memory of the past, by which I mean I'm not living in a kind of perpetual present, but I don't have... Compared, for example, with my brother, who has an excellent memory, can remember details of my life that I've forgotten, apart from his own life, my memory is rather selective and, if I can put it this way, rather abstract. So I don't have lots of very vivid memories. I mean, I do have memories of the past. Some of the earliest memories of childhood. I can remember being at the seaside. I can remember fragments of being in different places. But I don't really have any narrative memories, as it were, that go back very far.
Mm-hmm. I find that memories tend to be very composite as well, that sometimes you associate, like going to the seaside, but all the trips to the seaside become imbued. You know, you put them all together.
And are they really memories is the question, isn't it?
Yeah, and from a different perspective. Well, we'll come to some perhaps more philosophically based questions afterwards, but that sense of whether sometimes you extract some of the not so good from the good, and you almost have this sort of packaged all the good memories of going to the seaside joined together, whereas in reality they may have been fairly pedestrian or mundane days with a few
exciting moments. This is happening in what's called nostalgia, isn't it? There is a very selective process or even an interpretation going on rather than a raw memory, as it were.
But and what I found both through doing these interviews but also through the research is that nostalgia isn't all about the good memories, and in some ways I think it's about the challenges. We know, I can think back to particular periods in my life where I felt autonomous, or I thought, okay, how do I address this challenge? Or, you know, it might be as a student you're worried about impending deadlines. You know, what do you do about it? Do you sit and worry, or do you say, well, I'll go to the library and I'll get all these books out and I'll understand that aspect of theology which I'm struggling with? And then when you've got that right, you say, actually, okay, I've overcome that. And then you might go and have a drink with your friends in the bar or play some pool. And for me, it's that juxtaposition that you can be both intellectually satisfied or nurtured, and also to feel that there's a sense of community, maybe have a few drinks and just enjoy the company of peers. And in many cases now, if I'm not in touch with some of those same people, I haven't seen them in 25 years, I look back and think, well, the occasions when I met them were contextualized by dread and fear of what we were going to do with the rest of our lives. Short term, yes, getting a degree, or even shorter term, getting that essay in that was due at 5 o'clock the following afternoon. But I'm not somebody who can even say go on holiday and just, inverted commas, relax. In fact, I even find now some people say, well, why don't you just go home and just lie down or watch the TV of an evening? I go to the cinema every night. But I think it's just finding ways of being stimulated. And I think that that has carried with me certainly since my undergraduate days, when that sense of autonomy, rather than have a parent who can say, okay, here's your tea, or, you know, everything you want is prescribed or sort of given to you on a plate, sometimes literally. And yeah, and that sense of growing up. And for me, I'm nostalgic about that period when I became independent, which was certainly not a period without its challenges, but rather than necessarily a sort of childhood golden age, which I don't believe ever existed.
No, it's interesting you talk about the golden age of childhood, because one thing I've not done, but my brother and sister have done, is to go back to our North London area. They've even knocked on the door of our old house. Now, I deliberately didn't want to do this, because I thought it would destroy a certain kind of memory I have. I do have many memories, despite what I said of having a rather abstract, fragmentary memory. I've certainly got plenty of memories of my time in London. But I felt that, rather like Arthur Whaley, the sinologist, who never went to China, because he didn't want his view of China, which was nurtured on, you know, ancient China and classical China, to be destroyed by the realities of Mao's, you know, communist state. And in a way, I think I'm a victim of that, well, defect, perhaps you can call it, because I'm naturally inclined to be nostalgic. And that makes me deliberately future-oriented. So I'm a naturally nostalgic, rather sentimental person, easily someone who could cling to the past and regret the past and so on and so forth. But because of that, I have learned, and it's taken me some years, I think, not to look back and to go forward and to look forward.
Mm. Certainly there's a correlation between the two, but what you were saying there reminded me of how I struggled some years ago to think, well, what happens when you meet your heroes? I've met filmmakers, I've met radio presenters, and sometimes I think, well, was that the right thing to do? Because in some cases you find that they really are human after all, and sometimes you mythologize them, or you put them on a pedestal. And what happens then when you fall in love with somebody's films and you find some meaning in them? And in some cases you might go on to write essays, or if you're in an academic context, you might write a book or a thesis on their work. And when you meet them, you think, actually, it was really more about me than about them. Yes. It's what I got from the film. I met, actually, it was Thelma Schoonmaker, who edited a number of Scorsese's films, and I was so thrilled to meet her because of this Canterbury connection. She was married to Michael Powell. Mm. And when I met her and I mentioned that I'd studied Scorsese as part of my PhD, perhaps I'd hoped that she might get very excited and want me to talk about that and why I'd focused on redemption. But I almost felt that I was crossing a line that I didn't know was there, because I think she just found the situation very awkward. And I don't know why, I just assumed that because I was studying all of this, that somehow I'd met a like-minded person. But I just felt that that enthusiasm perhaps was just being disseminated in the wrong context, or maybe it was just the social situation and she wasn't expecting, or maybe she thought I was going to start asking some very complicated and long questions, which she didn't have time for. But it took me a while to process that, and it made me sort of step back and think, if you align yourself sometimes to particular memories or particular places or particular personalities, that sometimes meeting those or going there can sometimes take away some of the magic which actually we have formulated because it appeals to us at a particular time in our lives, and where we have perhaps encountered there's a certain synergy, or there's a certain sense of connection somewhere which comes from within rather than from that external source.
Because the other thing is that if you go back to, say, somewhere where you've grown up, it's not the same place anyway. This is one of the major faults of nostalgia, of course, that you can't actually, not only can you not retrieve the past, but you can't retrieve the place either. Of course, some places may not change very much, but a place is created not by just by buildings and, perspectives and things. It's created by the people who are around, and they're bound to have changed. So, for example, I would never think about being nostalgic about Kent, because Kent's changed so much. I mean, the university I'm talking about, the people that I knew here and worked here are probably all gone, almost. So I can't be nostalgic about it, partly because I come back periodically anyway. So
yeah,
I don't have a kind of illusion about Kent as I do about my early years in London, which is kind of preserved as a kind of, rather like Nutwood, I suppose, or Rupert Bear. It's that kind of a place which doesn't exist anymore and is part of an image, a fantasy, really. But I don't want to... I can't see the point of going back and, as it were, dismantling that. I wouldn't get anything in return.
Because I read a novel, I think I was talking to you about this a few years ago, that was set on this very campus in Kent in 1976 during the long, hot summer. And it was set in 76, but I think there was also a throwback to the Second World War. So it was sort of written about a decade ago, but set in the 70s. But the characters there were also reflecting on, I think it was a student who was doing some work on the Second World War. So there were sort of three different timelines, 40s, 70s and present day. And certainly through radio programmes like Sounds of the 70s, whenever we have a hot summer, everyone is talking about the summer of 76. But you were here at that time. What's your take on this sense of being in a campus that has changed so much over the years? But, for me, I was 3 years old in 1976, but I almost feel I have this image of what 1976 was like, built on very partial and fragments of memories that I have of going to a caravan site in Tenby in West Wales, actually. Or maybe I should get that corroborated from my parents. But and the hot weather, but and the water drought. But what about something like that? When people talk about 76, you were here at that time. Does that evoke any particularly pleasant or bittersweet memories?
Not particularly, no. I mean, my memories are very fragmentary. It might be a person, or it might be a series of things I was doing or reading. I don't really have a continuous memory of being at Kent. It's all sort of rather telescoped, and of course, as you get older, it becomes more foreshortened in a way.
So no sense of history in the making, as it were?
Not really, no. It's more like a Buddhist view of the self, you know, that it's ever-changing. It doesn't really have a fixed identity.
Yeah, because sometimes I've got a clear sense of when things happened. I've always kept a diary, so I can always go back and check. But it is interesting sometimes looking back and seeing what was happening either side of particular events I'm remembering. So there might be a conversation, I might be remembering a conversation I had with you, you know, 12 years ago in the Gulbenkian. But then I might see in a diary that there was something on the radio at the time, like maybe the next morning. And I think, that's peculiar. You know, there's a certain jarringness that I remember both events, but I wouldn't have put them together.
Right.
And I think that sometimes change happens and we acclimatise to that change. It's like looking at a photograph of someone when they had a different haircut or, you know, wore different clothes. It's suddenly, it's them, but it's not like them. But then you just adjust to that very quickly. But sometimes it's easy to forget that on particular past occasions, maybe somebody hadn't made that particular leap, or suddenly somebody hadn't, you know, the light bulb hadn't gone, hadn't yet come on. And it's interesting to look at somebody's pathway or a path that they didn't realise that they were on at a particular time, sure, but seemed from the perspective of where they are now.
Oh, yeah.
But you had 40 years of that. Yeah,
indeed. Kent. Looking at a photograph, I mean, many people might say, yes, I remember that, or I remember looking like that, remember that haircut. Mm-hmm. But they might then not know exactly when the photograph was taken, and they might suggest a date and be told, no, actually, it was 2 years before or two years later. So, you know, even very clear memories aren't necessarily fixed in a chronology for you. Mm. I mean, I'm one of the only people in the world who don't remember where they were when Kennedy's death was announced. Well, I must have been at Sheffield, but I don't remember. I don't link it to a particular moment or part of the day, whereas when John Lennon was shot, I remember exactly where I was, listening to the radio in my office in Darwin. Mm. You know, so you can't really pick and choose, I think, what you remember and what you don't.
What else do you remember from that? So you remember being in your office in Darwin?
Yes.
Was there the radio, was the programme interrupted?
Yes, it was. It was interrupted. John Lennon has been shot in New York, you know, so.
And
I remember where I was, you know, on 9/11 and stuff like that, and death of Diana.
Because I remember those, and I'm always a little bit embarrassed, because I remember the morning when Diana died, I was going to go and rent a film to watch. It was a Sunday morning, and I was going to go and watch, it was the sequel to the Jack Nicholson Terms of Endearment film, and Evening Star, and I was just about to go, and this was on the news, and I also thought, it seems almost inappropriate, you know, with this going on in the news, to go and, you know, rent out a VHS, but at the same time I thought, well, I'd planned to do that, I'll get it out. And in the end, I think I watched bits of the film in fragments, but I couldn't lure myself away from the news. But what I do remember was talking to a housemate, and I said, have you heard the news? And I said, oh, you know, Princess Diana has died. And of course he started laughing and said, oh, come on, you know. And I said, no, it's true. And then he realised that I wasn't joking. And there was just that moment when everybody just said, where's the nearest TV? Because this was in the age before social media. So we were all huddled around the TV in my room and just sort of looking at each other and just thinking, now this is a turn up for the books. But yeah, so John Lennon, yes. What was your... Were people talking about that in the same way? Because I remember when Jill Dando died, and I associate that with being on a lunch break. I was about to go back to my office. I just submitted my PhD. I was waiting for the Viva, you know, like a couple of months later. And this was such peculiar news, because she'd been on the front cover of the Radio Times that week, and she was, you know, I think she just started taking over a new antiques programme. But I remember watching the snooker score, and Steve Davis was doing really well in the Embassy World Snooker Championship. And then the death of Diana, which I saw on teletext, and then I went to work, and people were having normal conversations, inverted commas, and I thought, I felt I had to say, have you seen the news? Because in some cases they had. I thought, but you're just having like ordinary conversations, but somehow something that was so peculiar had happened, and it perhaps impacted me in a way that it hadn't on them. And that also surprised me. It's like when I mentioned it, they were like, yeah, well, oh dear, you know, but it affected them in a different sort of way. But maybe that's because I used to watch the news a lot in those days, and she was somebody I'd was used to watching. She was like a go-to person on the 6 o'clock news or breakfast news. But when John Lennon died, what was the sense on campus? Were people in shock? Were people upset? Were they crying? Or was it just a normal day?
Yeah, I mean, obviously people had heard and they were talking about it, but I don't think it was, say, like 9/11, where there was really a lot of media coverage, and it was just something announced. Then they would play a lot of his music and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I remember when John Smith died as Labour leader, yeah. and I was living in Lampeter. It was around, I think, about a week before, it was the Thursday before my exam started, and the local radio transmitter was being repaired. So we had no TV or radio on that day, so only in fragments. And I was, I think maybe I was able to pick up something on Five Live, which carried proceedings in Parliament. But again, strange association. So when I think back to the time when I did my degree finals, I very much associate it with all the talk of leadership speculation. Will it be Blair or will it be Brown or Robin Cook or Jack Cunningham who take over as leader of the Labour Party? And that, you know, peculiar juxtapositions, but which for other people wouldn't really be there in the same sort of way.
Yeah.
And it also shows my dependence on media, because I remember telling some friends about this, and you know, they didn't have the radio on, or they were busy writing essays, and for them it was like, oh gosh, that's terrible news. But somehow life carried on for them in a way that for me, I found it very hard to. It was more like, well, this is a major news story, and it perhaps exposed just how excited I was. I started my first election, as you know, the first time I was able to vote was in 92, so suddenly it was like, gosh, the next time I have a chance to vote, you know, who's going to be the next prime minister?
You've changed the course of that. History.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, not yeah. me personally, but linking that with a very parochial environment, being, I said parochial, you know, living in Lampeter, miles away from what was going on in Westminster, but somehow that those are some very abiding memories of that period. Something I didn't ask you, but what about your parents? What did they do? Because you obviously went to university.
Yes.
But was that something that you were expected to do? Was there a family tradition or expectation that you would go to university?
Well, neither of my parents had been to university. Of course, they were born before the Second World War and things were difficult and so on and so forth. My father was actually a teacher, a lecturer in training colleges in psychology. My mother was a housewife. Until all three children had left home, and then she trained to be a teacher and had, you know, 10 years or so very successfully as a primary school teacher. So there was a kind of, you know, there's a bookish element in the house, of course. We were encouraged to learn and do our homework properly and expected to do well at school. And my sister went to a training college, became a teacher. I went to Sheffield University, and my brother went to university to Birmingham. So yeah, it was not exactly a family tradition, but it was a natural thing for us to do, to go on from sixth form to, you know, higher education.
No, in my case as well, because my sister is also interestingly an academic, but we were the first generation, you know, to go to university in our family. But there was something almost inevitable about it, in the sense that at that particular time, late 80s, early 90s, yeah. That's what, at the school we went to, we were kind of almost expected to do, or it was hoped that we would do. But also in terms of the A-levels that I was taking, which were very humanities-based, you know, it was unlikely that I was going to find a job in terms of my interests, you know, that
you
university
could have
gone into
wasn't going to... service, I suppose.
I don't know. I think at that age, the only job I've ever done outside of university, it was within a university, but it was as a stock taker in my university library, and that was while I was doing my master's. So I think university was inevitable, because I was sort of unemployable in the sense that I had no life experience, no skills, and I learnt
Like you've spent your whole life in institutions, starting with a family and ending in
I've never left, and then just thinking now that the students who will be starting, because we're talking now in September, but the students who are going to be starting in a week or two were born in some cases as late as August 2000, which was only 4 years before I came to Kent, but also generationally that means that they were born 6 years after I got my degree and 1 year after I got my PhD. So generationally, that also, I don't know how you feel about that, because you've seen so many different generations of students come and go over the years. But in terms of how that fits with your own biography, and also members of staff, like someone like myself, I guess, who obviously arrived as a colleague many years after you started here, but that must, certainly in my mind, that sort of thing wreaks havoc with my sense of self and perspective.
Well,
and
I
age.
Remember the frightening years were those when I realised that the parents of the students I was teaching were younger than me, and that really started, you know, getting you worried. Should you still be here?
Well, yeah, and I'm at that stage now. I'm 45, and I'm 1 year younger than my mother was when I went to university.
Right.
So I'm conscious.
It's going to happen to you.
It will happen. I think it already has. Even maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I'd be talking to the parents of students at graduation and convinced that they're not, you know, they may have had their son or daughter when they were maybe in their early 20s. So, you know, it fits. But my goodness, when you realise that you have become the age that your parents were when you were young, but without feeling that you're any different. I mean, in some ways, in terms of the interest, there's a certain continuum, I feel. You know, age-wise, yes, I'm mid-40s, but I do feel that in some ways the same interest that I have, both in terms of the films that I like watching or the conversations that I have with friends, you know, it sort of feels that it's not that different from the world of them. No, I'd agree with
you there. I think around about the age of 30 or 35, you keep getting older, of course, but you sort of flatten out in how you see yourself. I think your own mental and bodily image of yourself is much, much younger than, well, in my case, it is much, much younger than it actually is. And so I think, yeah, after a certain age, there isn't that tremendous change that there was in the 10 or 20 years before.
Mm. What about music influences at different stages of when you were growing up? Because certainly for me, listening to what was in the charts, the sort of the sounds from the time you mentioned John Lennon, but what sort of impact did all of that have on you? Were you sort of somebody who was very aware of contemporary music, or you know, what was the sort of music that you grew up with? What did you used to listen to if you used to listen on the radio, or maybe it wasn't a music based program
when I was in the sixth form, I wasn't listening to pop or rock. I was listening to modern jazz and Indian music, and from there I got into classical music, which my parents listened to, but I kind of got into it via modern jazz and Indian music. I then discovered modern classical music like Bartok and stuff like that. Gradually extended my range until now. I suppose my favourite form of music is Baroque music, particularly Baroque operas. Never really had that much interest in pop or rock, although I've listened to it and I've got many discs of it as well. So I do select. I'm very eclectic in my musical as in my academic interests. So it's always been an important part of my life, music, listening to music. I did take piano lessons as a child, didn't get very far, but enough to, as it were, know something about it from the other side of the speakers, as it were. So yeah, music's important. And of course, probably like you, there are certain pieces of music, songs or tracks that evoke certain periods in my life. The music is part of one's memory of the past. You know, when you first listened to something or when you first started getting into a particular composer.
So I've often wondered if I've been unconsciously writing almost like letters to my older self, because if there was something on the radio that I liked, it may have just been a song, I would often record it.
Yes.
And I still have those tapes, and I digitised them a few years ago. So I listened to them on a constant loop in the car, like 80, 90 hours worth of this. And that's just from a particular set of, you know, stuff that, you know, beginning in university. There's a lot of earlier stuff from when I was at school that I haven't even listened to in decades. But it's almost as though in listening to those, each time I hear a particular song, I can remember where I was, who was presenting the show on the radio. And again, it's that juxtaposition that I'd be in somewhere like Lampeter, which was a beautiful place, but perhaps one of the appeals in terms of why I went there, a long way away from London or any big cities. And yet I would often listen to Radio 2 or Radio 4, which were London-based. But it was that juxtaposition of something outside, something external, something other, which was playing out in a much more localised, rural environment. And that kind of worked, because it felt slightly out of place, but that gave it a certain appeal, a certain mystique. It was almost an interesting connection. You know, that was the connection. It was the virtual connection with the rest of the world. And that, I think, made it very easy for me to live there for as long as I did, because I felt that I wasn't completely adrift. I wasn't completely cut off or lonely, because the radio was a great companion. But recording all of these moments that felt special, or special enough at the time to press the record button, listening to it again now, hasn't changed at all. I don't listen back and think, oh, you know, what was that interest? I can remember exactly, you know, if I was to go back now, I would do exactly the same thing at exactly the same time. So it's that continuity. It's almost as though I am recording nostalgic episodes that I will in the future, you know, think
does
of in a nostalgic
light.
Does
it press
the
nostalgia button for you then? Is that what it does, listening to these pieces of music?
It's always, but of course I also anticipate, I know it's going to be there,
yes.
But it's organic. It's not like in the car I think, oh, I want to have a particular nostalgic experience. It's going to happen inevitably because there's a sense of control. I know what I'm doing. There is something exciting about having something come on the radio which you don't know is going to come on, and you think, wow, actually, just yesterday I was Fat Larry's band in Zoom, and I thought 1982, and I remember immediately being at my grandfather's or my grandparents' house in Fairwater in Cardiff, and as soon as that came on, it took me to a world when I was 9 years old, and all the things that I used to do, used to play and read Enid Blyton books, and just that one song on the radio as I was just driving off campus the other evening.
Yeah.
So that was just triggered by that one song, and
yes,
immediately, even watching them on Top of the Pops, and they were very, you know, he was called Fat Larry, and indeed, you know, he was somewhat overweight, but all of that came back to me.
Yeah, well, I have the same experiences. I mean, for example, listening to bits of The Last Night of the Prom, some of those pieces, we used to have old-fashioned LP records, you know, which we played on a wind-up gramophone. And I can remember listening as a child to these old, they were old even then, I think, old records. And that kind of brings it back when you hear them played in a completely different environment. There's a little bit of you that's remembering the days when you actually listen to them on old-fashioned gramophone records with all the hiss and scratch that goes with them. Elgar, for example, stuff like that, Pomp and Circumstance, these kinds of things they play at The Last Night of the Proms.
How do you feel if that comes on and you're with somebody else and they don't necessarily have the same experience? Do you feel the need to explain that to them, or is this going on in your head and you just sort of leave it there? Or do you feel the need sometimes to want to share that, or to feel quite aggrieved if you feel this thing that's so...
I don't think you can share it, really, and that's why it's probably best to have those moments on your own. You can't really share your nostalgia with somebody else. I suppose you can if you were literally with those people in the past. But they may have a different take on that episode or that place. You see, you can't guarantee that one person's taste of the nostalgia banana is the same as your taste of it. It just can't be done. Something sort of very personal.
But I found before going back to my old university reunion, I met up with a few old university friends in a different environment in Cardiff, as it happened, and immediately we clicked. And we were carrying on with the same conversations almost that we'd had from the early 90s, and that was important to me because it also proved that it wasn't all completely in my head. I wasn't romanticising the past completely, because this connection was something that I felt that it was. I was apprehending them in the same way that I had back then. I enjoyed their company, and it was almost as though there'd been this break, this fissure in time, but this felt right. It was almost as though these were friendships that were worth cultivating. It wasn't, I mean, that's the worst thing sometimes when you have friends or relationships, and then many years later you feel that maybe your apprehension of that particular period in your life is not shared by them, and maybe, you know, you're in the right place at the right time, and then people move on, and, you know, we all have those sort of expedient moments. But for me, I thought it really is the people. It's not just the place. And so that nostalgia, as you said, in terms of going back to the old house where you grew up, and whereas your brother and sister would literally knock on the door, you wouldn't. I agree with that. I think that it's the difficulty is if you go back somewhere and you find that it has changed, and then it distorts or causes you to reflect differently on particular memories that are set, and then you have this dissonance, and you don't necessarily know where that's going to go, and, you know, it's a gamble as to whether it's worth embracing or whether actually that's going to really set you back.
Yes. Talking of meeting old friends, I mean, I've got two different experiences here. I have friends I meet occasionally, old friends, who want to do nothing but talk about the past and even idealise the past, how better things were, and that I don't want at all. I find that very unfruitful and not a very good experience. But one continues to meet with a friend, but I much prefer another kind of friend. In fact, there's a good example. I met someone I hadn't seen for 10 or 12 years, or perhaps more, and somebody I was at Sheffield with, in fact. And he said about halfway through our conversation, first time we'd met for years and years, "I'm glad we're not just talking about the past," he said. Yeah. And I thought, yes, that's right. We had plenty of things to talk about in the present. Although there was a continuity, we found that our friendship was, you know, had continued in a way, even though I hadn't seen them, been in touch with them periodically, but not seen them for 10, 15 years. So that's, I think, a good example of how looking back can be really narrowing and not productive.
Because I found that in terms of the way nostalgia is often associated with a particular sort of right-wing sensibility, the whole, oh, it used to be better in the old days, let's go back to those, and yes, certainly Brexit brought all that out. And it, from my point of view, I would certainly identify myself as left of centre, and yet I work with nostalgia, but I don't think and have never claimed that the past was better. There are some things, of course, that were done differently, and yes, of course, I might think, gosh, they were wonderful days because, etc. But for me, it's the opportunities, it's the personalities, it's the challenges that happened in the past and how we deal with those, rather than think it was better then. It might be a case of sometimes thinking, I wish I had those friends with me now. They were always the go-to people at moments of crisis. And I think for me, that would still stand, and certainly in terms of the friendships that I've managed to, you know, revisit in recent times, that sometimes you think, yeah, that what was special about the past was that there was this connection, and that connection will transcend the particular milieu, the particular geographical context of where you are. And I think that's very different from thinking those were better days, because in many cases they weren't. I mean, social media has its pluses and minuses, but I remember often visiting friends and being stuck on a train and you're late, you can't tell them where you are because you don't have a telephone, you don't have those sort of means. There are lots of things that you just had to deal with at the time. In many respects, this world is a better place, but it's also a very busy world sometimes. Yes. And I think it's easy to look back and just think, actually, sometimes we didn't have as many of the distractions as we do now. And I think we used to spend perhaps a lot more time in each other's company and enjoyed that, rather than necessarily sort of going off and in a sort of multimedia sort of interface environment, having too many distractions. Mm. But again, that's down to how we process and deal with those occasions, rather than it necessarily being better or worse per se.
Yeah, I think nostalgia is, I mean, it began as a term for a disease, didn't it?
Yeah, 17th like century Swiss soldiers. Yeah, yeah.
You've done all this research on this, I know. But so there's still this idea that nostalgia is not good for you. It's something you should shake yourself out of. At the same time, art would not be the same without the resources of nostalgia, would it? I mean, themes in art. The Odyssey is all about going home, coming back.
And Dante's Inferno, the whole sense of Proust journeying.
And all of this, yeah. So yeah. It's a rather Protean term, I find, nostalgia. It can mean something which is destructive or negative or narrowing. At the same time, it can be something which is a valuable resource for thinking about things in a wider perspective.
I often think with Dante that Beatrice was someone, you know, it was almost like the unrequited love. It was the relationship with Beatrice that he never had but wanted. And maybe that fits in with some of my own interpretations on the past, the what-if moments.
Yes.
But she becomes his muse precisely because there's no contamination. There's no, you know, it was the relationship, the ideal relationship that he can envisage rather than one that he actually may have had.
Yes.
And that's why she's able to travel with him on his journey through hell and upwards. Whereas if they had have dated, if they had have been married, if they'd been in a relationship, he'd have needed a different sort of muse perhaps. And I'm wondering if we, and that also is a concern I have about going back and restoring or reconnecting with some of those acquaintances, because what happens if they are better, they're more perfect in the memory, in the imagination, like with the professor who had never been to China? The idea of China or the idea of particular people from my past is far more efficacious than the actuality of seeing them again.
Yes.
But sometimes you don't know, and it's a difficult line to straddle.
Yeah. I suppose grief is one of the most extreme contexts for nostalgia, isn't it? Is grief good or not? Is the memory, the painful memories you have, or the fact that someone has gone forever, you can't retrieve experience with them. So nostalgia is a strange word. I mean, it's you look at it one way and it looks like a negative thing. You look at it another way and it looks like a very positive thing. And where you stand on this.
Yeah, I think it's a continuum whereby sometimes in order to go forward, there has to be some element of learning. Sometimes we consciously and sometimes unconsciously learn from mistakes, or sometimes we just don't do it at all. And I think for me, the important thing about nostalgia is that I'm able to say, well, in that particular situation, I did X. Maybe if I'd done Y, something very different would have happened. In truth, though, I find myself now in my 40s in similar situations to those I found myself in when I was, say, a teenager. And perhaps I revert to type, and sometimes I think, yeah, you know, sometimes I might feel uncomfortable or embarrassed in somebody's company, and I don't ask those pressing questions. Or, you know, you sometimes think, what if I ask that person, you know, will she go out with me if I ask? Oh, no, actually, she may say no, I won't ask. And I sometimes think there's a core me, which, and that's almost the nostalgia. It's almost that where I was then, where I am now, there's this continuity, but it reminds me that I've been in these positions before, and almost I have the resources to deal with them. It doesn't always translate into do you do X or do you do Y, but it's more of knowing that you've been there before, and you know that there is a way forward, there is a way through this.
It's interesting that you're making nostalgia a very cerebral thing, whereas I thought that one of the major components of nostalgia is the longing, the feeling of wanting something from the past you know you can't have simultaneously. Mm. Isn't that one of the driving forces of nostalgia?
Yeah.
That it's a kind of a longing, you know, can never be required, you can never go back. It's a kind of exacerbation of your loss.
I think that's how I see it, though. I mean, in some cases, I absolutely have pined for friendships, relationships, in some cases that I didn't have but wish I'd had.
Yeah.
So can you be nostalgic about something that didn't happen but you might have had? And it's the what-if scenario. So I think cerebrally, I don't know. I find...
It's the what-if element I'm getting at, you see. Mm. It's as if you're looking at the past as a series of forks in the road, and did you take the right one?
Except I'm feeling those.
The road not taken, the Frost poem, you know.
Yeah. But I think in my case... whereas a lot of my writing is cerebral, and you know, I can't shake the academic way of writing in the sense that, you know, and that's a good thing. If I'm writing an academic book, there's a very particular structure, and I use lots of quotations, and I almost corroborate my ideas with words of others. But in studying nostalgia, and it might be one of the reasons why I wanted to go down the path of recording these interviews, is the sense that this is not just a project, this is not just an idea, it's not just something cerebral. I feel it every time I hear a piece of music, every time I think of an old friend, or watch a film. Sometimes there are certain triggers, and there's a wistfulness there, and I really do feel it, and I find it with dates as well, particular periods. Now that I'm on Facebook, it often tells me what I was doing a year ago today, but Facebook doesn't need to tell me that. Sometimes I mean we're about to start the new academic year, and that feeling of apprehension, slight nervousness, I have it every year, but I can remember where I was this time last year and certain things going in my life. And it's interesting that because it's that same time of year and it gets dark a little bit earlier, and the summer is fading, and the weather has turned, I feel all of that. And it's something, you know, and it's not just, oh gosh, that was a year ago. I can almost tap into those same dynamics, which often are calendrical. And I find it around Christmas. I'm always remembering past Christmases. Mm. And that's not a forced thing. It's not because I'm seeking it out through the pages of diaries. But even on these tapes that I listen to, sometimes particular songs will come on, and I'm immediately transported back to a particular time. And if that coincides with the present calendar date, I mean, there have been occasions when I'm listening to something, say, in the month of May, and it's something I recorded in May 1992, and particularly if you then hit the quarter of a century mark, I'm absolutely taken back there, and almost to the point that there have been occasions when I almost feel I need to stop the car and just breathe or practice mindfulness.
Yes.
Because it really has affected me, so it's very far from cerebral.
Yes, mindfulness is almost the opposite of nostalgia, isn't it? Because it's living very much in the present, as distinct from dwelling in the past or longing for the past. I'm wondering what approach you're going to take in your book on nostalgia. I mean, is it going to be thematic, or are you going through the way it's been apprehended in Western culture?
And also particularly in different traditions. So there's lots of work on nostalgia in film studies, in sociology, yes, and psychology, not so much from religious studies. And yet when people use the language of transformative encounters, mystical encounters, and the way in which they sometimes will draw on this sort of prelapsarian past.
Also Eliade with his idea of nostalgia for paradise, that's an important thing.
Yeah, Eliade has come up quite a lot, actually.
Yes.
And there's actually an article which I only found, maybe through you actually, not too long ago, on Eliade and theology, or Eliade and the fall in paradise.
So
that might be the hook that I take.
And I hope in films you will look at two of the great nostalgic films, which is Peggy Sue Got Married, Coppola, 1986, and Frank Perry's The Swimmer, 1968.
Oh, Burt Lancaster.
Burt Lancaster, yeah. Very odd film, but very moving film.
That is a very surreal film, actually. Somebody said to me once, if you watch it, you need to watch it again, you know, and I've only seen it once.
He's about nostalgia, you see, in that film. And in fact, it doesn't pay off. It's a sad film.
Well, somebody the other day invited me to post my 10 favourite films on Facebook, and I thought, well, obviously I can't do it. I can't do 10. And immediately, I think I just drew up a list. I was at 100 before I was able to think about it. And so what I've started doing is trying to change the dynamics a bit of actually saying not just this is my favourite film and this is what happens in the film, but how it impacted on me.
Yes.
And I was actually on Dover Beach recently, and I had my iPhone, and I thought, let me just do this. And I just filmed myself talking about why The Fugitive, and it was the seeing of The Fugitive, the Harrison Ford film, with a friend in 1993, and it was the whole experience. And I remember even the trip on the minibus, and Bob Harris was on Radio 1 in those days. He was coming to the end of his tenure there. And it was remarkable, really, because this one film, which is about, effectively a chase film and a bit of a whodunit, fitted into a particular where I was at a time when I was doing my degree, and fitting lots of, the tapestry of my life together, obviously without the one-arm killer element. But for me, it was, it was never about the film per se. It was where I was and the environment. Peggy Sue Got Married. Is that a particular
appeal for you? But that's a film about nostalgia in a way, isn't it? About someone actually, almost time-travelling back to their own childhood or youth as themselves, as their adult selves. Mm. Very clever film, actually.
Mm.
Comedy, but rather a moving film about relating to your past and coming to terms with your past in order to move on.
Mm. Yeah, but that's all about whether she should have married
Nicolas
Cage.
That's
and
right.
Her marriage is coming to... I can't actually remember what happens, but she does go back, but a bit like The Wizard of Oz, she goes on this journey and then she finds herself and then she comes back with a new perspective.
But all the people in the past treat her as if she was the young Peggy Sue. That's why it's funny and also quite moving. I mean, she's got the adult memories as well.
And of course played by the same actress, Kathleen Turner, which gives it a...
That's a great film. But any film can be nostalgia provoking. You can load onto it your own nostalgia, of course.
Everything from Groundhog Day to Pleasantville
certainly
appeal there. And also I think the way that the film almost changes, our apprehension of the film changes, but to engage with the same film in different periods and actually finding that, sometimes the older you get, the more you can tap into. It didn't work for me actually on Field of Dreams, but somebody once said, maybe it's the sort of film you need to watch when you're a little bit older. If you watch it when you're only 15 years old, like reading Shakespeare at school, you never completely get it. You have to be a little bit more mature in your mindset. Although I've watched Field of Dreams many times and I've never quite bought into it, but I want to. Because everything about the film, everything I've ever read or seen reviewed about it, does tap into my filmic and wider sort of nostalgic interest. But something doesn't quite click there, but I will give it more opportunities.
Yes.
I think you've actually answered a lot of the more sort of philosophical questions, but would you say that in your own life, some of your own memories, whether childhood or university or your subsequent career, are predominantly positive, or can you be nostalgic about maybe more bittersweet or negative experiences or memories?
Well, you definitely can be, I think, and that may go back to feelings of regret for things you've wished had been different, or choices you think you could have done differently. But I think nostalgia on the home is longing for something. It's a desire.
Mm.
It's definitely not a Buddhist good thing. It's an unskilled state of mind as far as Buddhism is concerned, I think.
No, I think you're right, because it's a longing for a home that isn't there.
Yeah, or is different from what it was. See The Swimmer, the film.
Yeah.
That will drive that point home.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what about the question of whether you have fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young? If you had them, I mean, was there a sense that you expected to go on a particular path and you didn't go on it? And in many respects, you've had a wonderful, rich career. But do you sort of think, is that what you wanted to do? Was there something else that maybe you envisaged doing, but which didn't quite happen for you? And do you perhaps look back and think, what if?
there are some what-ifs, like I mentioned, you know, doing well at Latin at school and thinking what would have happened had I studied languages more. Because I think I was and am good at languages, but have never really developed them as an academic subject. But not really anything major. I don't think I've ever been a terribly ambitious person. Certainly, even as an academic, I'd never describe myself as a career academic, wanting to do well as an academic, in other words, get to being professor or something like that. I've always, as it were, taken things as they are and enjoyed them, enjoyed doing them. I think now that I'm retired, I've got a much more urgent sense of wanting to do something.
Every time I see you, you've got a new book out.
Well, that's not quite true. I mean, I've, since retiring in 2011, I've written a couple of books, and I'm now well into the third, and I've got three more planned in my head. So that is perhaps as ambitious as I've ever been about getting those done. But I'm sure that's to do with my age rather than my temperament or my personality. I'm not an ambitious person. I'm a herbivore, not a carnivore. That explains anything, I don't know.
How do you find when you meet up with old school friends or university friends, and you've already touched on some of this, when you, you know, do you talk about the past, or do you talk about, do you look a bit more to the future? But what sort of connections are there? Do you find that you are able to go back to some of those old friendships and relive them, or is it good sometimes just to put them in little boxes and keep them there? Maybe occasionally take them out of the box, maybe at Christmas or meet up with old friends. But do you know what's your relationship? Do you sort of feel sometimes that we all move on in different ways, and sometimes it can be unproductive sometimes to try and almost artificially create those.
I think there are people who do try and over-egg going back to see old friends who haven't maintained contact with. I mean, once or twice I have met with old friends I haven't seen for years or even decades, and, as it were, just carried on as if nothing had happened, which is amazing. But not talking about the past particularly, not even talking about the future, but talking about the present, which is, I think, the best thing to be doing, actually, neither past nor future in a way. But I think often, you know, I have decided, or not formally, but in effect, decided that, you know, there's no point in pursuing a particular old friendship, because why hasn't it developed by itself? Why should I force it to carry on? And I think one does have to let friends go, people who were friends or acquaintances at least, in the past, you let them go. And it's a very Buddhist idea, I think.
I found this with a friend, actually, recently, who we were often in the same class at university, but we'd led very different lives, very different sort of backgrounds. And we met up again, and I think we both learnt that I was somebody who hadn't come out of my shell in those days, and she saw me as somebody who hadn't come out of my shell. So in a way, we were at that particular period, we were on very different trajectories. But somehow now, 30 years on, we've you know, maybe I've moved in one direction, she's moved slightly more in the other, and we've sort of met up in the middle. That was very interesting, because I was intrigued, but she's from my hometown, intrigued to meet up again. But certainly, in that case, we had very few conversations in the 1990s. But again, that's an interesting way of looking at nostalgia, the sense of the possibilities where, you know, we use the expression often being in the right place at the right time. But sometimes some friendships cannot develop or be cultivated at particular moments because you haven't got the resources in place to be able to sustain particular friendships. You know, you're not worldly wise enough, or you're not sophisticated enough, or whatever it might be.
Well, that person, the other person, is perhaps going through things that you can't be a part of. I think that's happened to me when I've met friends who've, at the time, didn't have particularly close relationship with them, and subsequently you may meet them again later, and you do. You find that they've come nearer to your interests or nearer to your view of things. That can happen too.
Yeah.
But so I think to force it and say, well, because I was a friend, I've got to go back to that reunion and meet them all. I mean, that's one thing I would never do, go back to a reunion, school reunion, university reunion. I would deliberately not do so. I do it selectively by maybe contacting people I knew, but to go back as a group, because I know what it would be like. It would be trying to relive the old days.
No, and often when you watch films like Gross Point Blank or Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion, I mean, I watch those with, I mean, sometimes people say, well, why are you watching
it's
films
film,
like that?
Gross Point Blank, actually.
Well, and I was thinking of the other one as well, because it plays on the whole sense of being at school, those dynamics, those, you know, the A-list and the B, and Heathers is another film that does the same thing, and you realise that sometimes the way that you're perceived by other people, your peers, and whether that change, I'm intrigued to know sometimes whether people who are the A crowd or the popular people, how they change over the years.
There is a curiosity you have to fight about it, but I think it's a bit like the Arthur Whaley thing again, that you don't in a way want to go back and see people perhaps turn out disappointing. And if you're really honest, you don't want other people to see perhaps you as disappointing. So there's a sense in which the past is best left alone, or rather is best left to nostalgia, perhaps, if not entirely forgotten about. There's a sense in which, you know, you're kind of almost muddying the water by going back to things that have, well, you've moved on from.
And actually, I think you've already answered my last question, which was whether you would consider yourself a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
Well, as I said before, I am temperamentally, emotionally a looking back person. But because of that, I think I have learnt to develop strategies of not looking back and not living in the past, but moving forward. I don't mean ignoring the present, but just not, living in the present perhaps as much as I can.
Peter Moore, thank you so much. This has been wonderful to relive some of our previous conversations, but it's been wonderful to catch up with you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.